Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome, everybody, to Season 1, Episode 8 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me tonight we have...
Kaylee Carruthers on the brand new Rancho Notorious couch.
We have our circumstances are improving on a week-by-week basis. Also joining us on the line is a friend of Rancho Notorious, Carter Nixon. G'day, Carter.
Hello, Dan. Hello, Kaylee. How are you both?
All the better for having you on the show, Carter.
Well, thank you for having me.
What have we got on the show today? Well, basically, we're going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy and the Marvel Universe with Carter very shortly. And also a little bit later on, we're going to be interviewing Kate Hawley, who's a friend of Rancho Notorious and also a extremely successful and getting more so costume designer who's just been...
I know Kate.
Yeah, she's been she's done a lot of work on The Hobbit and Miramar, and most recently she worked on Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, and she's been working a lot with Guillermo del Toro, so hopefully she'll be able to tell us a little bit about that, non-disclosure agreements notwithstanding. So she'll be along a little bit later on, but first, Kaylee, it's time for to find out what's been going on in the mailbag.
Yes, it's quite a full one this week.
That's good.
So I'll start out with Geekboy73, all caps, 2 question marks. How can you not know what The Purge is? Straight to DVD here. Great idea.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of pop culture knowledge missing in last week's show, so we apologise for that. We are supposed to be the arbiters of all that is good and good and decent.
Yes. He also followed it up with, I'm going to be live reacting to the latest RN, Rancho Notorious, that's us. So stand by for the next 1 hour 19 minutes by your machine. P.S. Purge Anarchy undated here.
And then he proceeded to not tweet anymore. We obviously blew his mind.
Obviously. Reese Pie tweeted us saying, ahem, sinisita, shine, Cheetah.
Yeah, so exactly. Also found wanting in the Italian pronunciation department last week. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry. It's French, sort of. One of my favorite two-word reviews that we've had this week is from S. Tyler. Kamiko ends if two-word review for Rancho Podcast. Bunzo forever. And if you have seen Kamiko the Treasure Hunter ends if, you'll know what she's talking about. If you haven't, I mean, you should really go see it because, yeah, Bunzo. It's all about the Bunzo. Cute.
One of my favourite films in the festival. Wondering whether it's going to get a chance to come back and appeal to even more people, but who knows?
RJ Movies tweeted a two-word review for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Digital Evolution.
Yeah, nice work.
Clever. And from Robert Cato, who's a name I strangely mispronounced last week on this show, so I have to apologize. I don't know what came over me.
Making friends and influencing people since the beginning of...
because Rancho Podcast was awaiting my tour review, apparently, Calvary equals Irish noon.
Calvary.
Calvary. Yeah, that's right. I can read people, okay?
It's been a long day at the New Zealand International Film Festival coalface, no doubt. We'll be getting some updates about the NZF a little bit later on. But outside of the festival, which of course marches its way down the country as we speak, opening in Christchurch today, I think, let's have a look at what people have been going to at the New Zealand box office, the official box office figures.
Yes, in at number 5, down from 3, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Opening at number 4, The Dark Horse. Awesome to see that in the top 5. In at number 3, down from 1, Hercules. Sitting at number 2, Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie. And number 1, Guardians of the Galaxy.
And the Guardians of the Galaxy manages to smash its way to number 1 on the basis of sneak previews only, like limited sessions.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
I know that most cinemas were only giving it 2 sessions a day over the weekend.
Wow.
So, yeah, we'll
number
be
one.
number one. Number one with a bullet. And as we're about to find out, as we work our way around the world.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it Bradley Cooper as a talking raccoon? I mean, really, how are you going to compete?
Yeah, and I think the performance of the year, perhaps the performance of the decade, is Vin Diesel. But we'll come to that a little bit later on. The UK box office top five, The Purge, Anarchy, which we've already discussed, number five. Number four, Hercules. And number three, How to Train Your Dragon 2, bumped off the number one spot, as you would expect, by Guardians of the Galaxy, is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, number one, with £6.25 million in the opening weekend, Guardians of the Galaxy. And I would imagine that that's on sneak previews as well, because I'm pretty sure its release date is the same worldwide. I'm about to hand you, let's see, this is the US, so if you want to do the US top five.
We literally just pull them out of a hat and tell you.
Or out of our butts.
Number five, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Four, Hercules. Three, Get On Up. No idea what that's about. Two, Lucy, which is the new film with ScarJo in it. And number one, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yep.
By a long shot.
So that's the US. In Australia, number five, Sex Tape. What is wrong with you people?
curious. They're just curious.
Number four, down from two, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Number three, look, isn't this kind of... We are somewhat scornful of the culture across the Tasman, but Mrs. Brown's Boys to Movie was not a number one film there. Number three, number two, Hercules, and number one, Lucy, which this is last weekend, so no sneak previews for Guardians in Australia. And we do our bit to check out what's going on in some of the other far-flung corners of the world when it comes to box office. So this week, we've got the weekend box office for Chile. Number five, The Purge, Anarchy. Number four, How to Train Your Dragon 2. This is a sign, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen, every week of how basically we are building one world culture, and it's not hours. Number three, Transformers, Age of Extinction 2, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Strain at number one, Guardians of the Galaxy. Looking a little bit further down, there's some interesting entries in the... I think we've got the top 16, actually, for Chile. Only one film in Spanish in the top 16, and that is an Argentinian film called Betty Boo, an Argentinian crime thriller, which made $550 at the Chilean box office.
A crime thriller called Betty Boo.
It is in week six. Yeah, Betty, Betty Boo. I think that's what that's little mark above the U
indicates.
Yeah,
Spanish listeners, please help.
Please help us out, yeah, because we're just hopeless at this stuff. Number 12, a film called Dino Time. Must have been the school holidays in Chile. A Korean animated film. And a film that I'd never heard of at number 10, straight in at number 10, No One Lives, a Luke Evans horror film from 2012. Is that you ever come across that one in your travels, Carter?
No One Lives? I think I have. I'm trying to think if it's the one I think of, but there's a whole bunch of these horrors that kind of go straight to iTunes and straight to VOD, but that name is very familiar, and I'm just trying to remember if I saw it. But you did mention one earlier, Get On Up, that's the James Brown biopic.
Oh, which hasn't come out here yet, which everybody's talking about as potential Oscar material for the lead
actor. Yeah, I think that it's actually really good.
Yeah, so and James Brown, of course, a story built for the cinema. You know, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, but it is PG-13, and so they're obviously definitely skimming over some aspects of his life.
Indeed. All right. So that's what's been going on around the world in terms of box office. Now it's time to get Carter, as it were. I promised myself all day that I wouldn't do that, and you know what?
I went named after the film.
Well, then it's entirely appropriate.
It's perfect.
All right. Let's talk Guardians.
Why would you want to save the galaxy? Because I'm one of the idiots who lives in it.
What the hell? I don't got that long a lifespan anyway.
I have a plan.
You've got a plan.
I have part of a plan.
What percentage of a plan?
I don't know. 12%.
12%? That's a fake laugh.
It's real.
Totally fake.
That is the most real, authentic, hysterical laugh of my entire life, because that is not a plan.
I am Groot.
All right, Carter. Now, we asked you to be on the show today because of all the enthusiastic responses to Guardians of the Galaxy that I have seen online, yours would be up there in perhaps the top 12% of enthusiastic responses. What was it about Guardians of the Galaxy that pushed your buttons?
Well, I mean, certainly expectations play a part, because I wasn't completely sold on the trailers. And I thought it was a hard sell, because it kind of, you know, I thought maybe it might have been a bit, looked a little weird with a talking raccoon and a talking tree. But I just had such a good time. I just thought it was so much fun and actually funny. Like, it was more of a comedy than anything else. And, you know, these kind of films that you go to, because they're meant to be, you know, crowd pleasers, and you can feel it in the crowd that people are having a good time. And, I just thought it took me back as well. So I grew up in the 80s, there were all these kind of Star Wars knockoffs, like Battle Beyond the Stars.
The Last Starfighter.
Adventures and Last Starfighter and Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin. And they were, these B kind of movie Star Wars knockoffs. And he kind of, I just think it had a similar, you know, kind of feel to those kind of films. So it felt almost like a big budget B movie.
I was going to ask you that, whether, because obviously it definitely has that Star Wars vibe. There's, you know, it's got like Han Solo's DNA all the way through it, if that's not a grubby image to put into your mind. But I was just wondering, you know, knowing the extent that that Marvel sort of crafts its stories, do you feel like that sorry, this is getting Skype beeps all around. Pardon me. Is that you making that noise? Knowing the way that Marvel crafts their stories for the maximum audience appeal and impact, do you think that this is something that's come from them, or do you think that this is something that's come from the writer-director James Gunn?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, because I was kind of surprised at how much of... how much kind of his weirdness came through in the film, and his humour, and I was kind of surprised that they let him get. I mean, there's one joke, the Jackson Pollock joke, that I thought it was kind of the dirtiest joke I've seen in a family film, you know, in a long time. And they obviously run a tight ship, and they definitely, you know, have a lot of control. Over their films.
It's a big gamble, isn't it, from Marvel's point of view, to spend this amount of money on essentially a property of theirs that not that many people know about. I mean, were you aware of the Guardians of the Galaxy before you started seeing trailers?
No, I'd never even heard of the comic. And I've been a comic guy, you know, through periods of my life I've had, you know, when I've been really into them, and I've got, you know, I collect... And comics, I hadn't even heard of it. I had friends going on about Rocket Raccoon and Groot, and I really just thought, man, they've got a hard sell on their hands, because I haven't even heard of this, and it's kind of in my wheelhouse of things I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And then I was surprised how many people had, and I think the fact that they have, I mean, their marketing is, it's obviously some of the best around, for it to open as big as it has.
They have been everywhere, definitely.
Yeah, like, they've really done the hard sell, and they've done it well, because it's, you know, it's done. And I'm glad it's done well. I get prone to hyperbole when I get all excited about a new film, and I make grand statements about it, and I don't want to sound like, oh, it's the best ever guy, but I mean, at this, you know, repeat viewings will tell if it is, but if it stays this way. But I think it's by far my favourite of the Marvel films so far.
Well, it seems to be the one that commits the most wholeheartedly to a particular tone. And doesn't,
yes.
You know, and it seems to have a point of view, which is, I sort of feel like those, mind you, there's different kinds of Marvel studio films, aren't there? Because the Spider-Man movies that were put out by Sony are still Marvel studio movies. They're still basically Marvel products. And yet those films haven't worked, or at least the two most recent ones.
No, they haven't. And I agree with you. I definitely feel like out of these, I think it's 10 now of the Marvel Studios studios, ones that they've made themselves, I feel like this has got more of a director stamp on it than any of the other ones. All the other ones are fairly kind of, I get mixed up in my head when I think about the finales of a lot of them. I kind of, you know, when I go back and think, was that in this one or what did that happen in? Was that in Avengers?
I can never remember who the villains are in all of these things. Yeah. And now, look, perhaps before we go on a little bit further, because it is so early in the film's run, there'll be a lot of people listening to this who perhaps are going, get on with telling me what it's about, people. So I'm going to put this one in your basket there, Carter. Can you summarise what this film is about?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's a group of space criminals come together and form a team, and I'm actually right now having a memory blank on the bad guy's name there, like you just said about the bad guys. And
he's
think
Irish.
One thing,
Ronan. His name's Ronan.
Ronan.
Yeah.
Is it Ronan? Yes. And like you just said, like the villains are kind of forgettable, and he's there's a it's got a MacGuffin. They're chasing an orb that if it gets into the wrong hands, it's going to cause a lot of damage. And he's going to be able to destroy cities and destroy planets. And basically, these five space criminals team up to stop him. I mean, that's a very basic kind of breakdown of what it's about. I'm just so scared. I mean, I just know people are so spoiler-phobic these days.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, you don't know how much to say about each character, but or what they do, but.
Well, we've got a genetically and indeed robotically enhanced raccoon, talking raccoon, yes, played by Bradley Cooper, who actually, you know, if, full credit to Bradley Cooper, you would never know that it was him. You know, it's not like there is a Bradley Cooper voice out there.
That's right.
But you know, full credit, I reckon, to Vin Diesel's agent on this one, because he's managed to get him, he's got the fourth billing, right, number four, and all he had to do was say the words "I am Groot" 1,000 times, apparently with different inflections. Yeah, that's what, that was it, just over and over again, different inflections, giving them choices, and there we go. Number four.
Big surprise for me in the cast was Dave Bautista, the wrestler who plays Drax the Destroyer.
He's fantastic.
He's great. He's so funny. And his comic timing, which is kind of, I was not expecting him to be funny.
Yep.
And to pull it off. And like he gets some of the funniest, you know, some of the funniest moments.
He's definitely the discovery.
Yeah. And wrestlers have a patchy history when it comes to crossing over to acting. And you know, he's just kind of, I thought this would be fantastic.
Yep. So now I'm going to the $1 million, or perhaps the $100 million question, when it comes to where this movie and where this franchise is going to go, is Chris Pratt. What do you think? I mean, he's moving up from schlubby best pal in sort of romantic comedies and a bit of TV sitcom work, and here he is. I'm pretty sure that he's very, very fortunate that this is an ensemble and that he's not having to carry this all on his own shoulders.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, he's already famous and he's in Parks and Rec and he's been around a while, but it is kind of like a star-making lead role for him. But you're right, he doesn't have to, he's not focused. Like, they all, each character gets, you know, enough screen time. It really is like a teen film.
Hmm.
Whereas he is the lead, obviously, but, you know, they all carry... And I just thought all five of those main characters, they were all great. And they all got their own, you know, they all got moments in the film. They all got their own little scene. And I liked their character so much. And I was able to... And that played a big part of me being able to not worry so much about the villain being kind of generic. I mean, it is kind of a generic quest of what they've got to do. Especially in the Marvel films, like the Tesseract, there's always something the bad guy's trying to get.
And aren't we going to find out in about five films' time that all of the things that they're all of the MacGuffins are basically the same MacGuffin? Aren't they all the weird bits of the universe, or bits of the universe that were blown up, or galaxies? Aren't they sort of? I lost track.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, because I mean, this, I know some guys, and they can tell you everything about each, like where they're all linking, and they know the entire comic book history, and they know where it's all linking. Whereas I just kind of try to go to the films and not worrying so much about where they're all linking with Marvel. Have this phase one and phase two and phase three, and it's going to all lead to Avengers 2. And
well, I mean, carry on.
I was going to say, luckily, I forget
about these things between movies, and so it's all kind of fresh to me. Which does actually make sometimes the watching of a film a little bit frustrating, because I did feel that there was a lot of setting up of future or teasing of future battles. In the same way that you're often in these sorts of movies nowadays, you get to defeat the henchman, but you don't get to defeat the power behind the throne, the really big supervillain, you know? So yeah, it's like there's always got to be some, you know, it's like, oh, can't we just finish these things for once?
Well, yeah, because there is obviously, without giving a spoiler, there is obviously another character in this film that they allude to who's been, they've kind of mentioned in a few of them now, without trying to, I want to say his name or give away a spoiler, but
you can't remember his name, can you?
Oh no! I can, but I don't know if people would consider it a spoiler or not that he's in it, because he wasn't in any of the ads.
Yep.
But and I know he's going to be the main villain in a future Marvel film. But and it feels like it's time to either let's get this guy to the front and have him like you said, enough of these henchmen. Let's get to the real threat.
Indeed. Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot now and. Well, actually, I'm not even ready to do this myself, so I won't put you on the spot. But you often on this show in the past, in past iterations of this show, we have tried to sum films up in two words. So if you feel up to it, do you think you could do a two-word review for Guardians of the Galaxy?
In two words? This sounds corny, but great fun. And when it comes to these types of movies, I think this is like the best you can hope for when it comes to these kind of blockbuster movies. In terms of you're going to see to have a good time.
Something else that I noticed in your tweets about it, and I saw those before I went to the film with my partner, and her response was very similar to your partner's response to it in terms of this is a film that actually has female appeal as well as just sort of teen fanboy or wish you were a teen fanboy appeal. It's good because the main character, for a change, he's got mummy issues instead of daddy issues. So there's actually that. There's a really quite a strong. Like they've quite cleverly wrapped the film in a kind of maternal positioning, which makes a big difference.
I didn't think about it. You're right. It's normally a lot of daddy issues. You're right. Mm. And it was and this time it's about his mother. I mean, my wife. I mean, she doesn't usually even come to these when I take the kids to these kind of movies. And if they're at home, she'll watch them, but she's not like, they're not the kind of films she's drawn to. And I mean, she loved this film. I mean, loved it.
And I think that is why that is why this film is going to be the biggest one of the year, or probably the biggest one US. But Transformers, if they can actually get the money out of China, it will be the biggest film of the year. But I think this one's probably going to be the biggest in the US, and it's that crossover that really is working for it. Carter Nixon, thank you very much for visiting with us here at Rancho Notorious.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Nice to talk to you both.
Still without our, we will be finding some more Western, country and Western news theme later.
Yes.
We're getting to that.
Yes, we're getting to it. Right. Well, let's start the news as we usually do with NZIF Festival News.
NZIF
Festival News. So the big news is, of course, we are heading into the final weekend in Wellington and the festival has ended in Auckland. Sad days.
There's a lot of angsty withdrawals online from people who now don't know what to do with their evenings.
Oh my goodness.
just before we get to that, I just want to say that if you missed Auckland, if like me, you were perhaps too unwell to see very much in Wellington as well, you can do a kind of vicarious catch up by looking at David Larson's blog in the New Zealand Listener. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. But he saw, and then he did what the kind of marathon that I used to do when I was when I was a well man. Absolutely full credit to him, because it's an extraordinary thing to not just go and see three or four films a day, but to write them up as well. And so, yeah, if you feel like you've missed out on anything, that's probably the best place to go, first place to go.
Mm. There's also lots of articles and interviews on the Lumiere Reader.
Mm.
And Radio New Zealand also has a whole section of all the interviews they've done with visiting filmmakers as well.
Great. Well, we'll put all of those on the what's it called? Show notes.
Linkathon. It's just going to be a linkathon. It's going to be great. Big things coming up this weekend, as well as the closing night, which is Wild Tales. It's also the live cinema with show people. It's going to be great. There's going to be the screening of the of a restored print, but a print nonetheless.
35mm, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm, running at 20 frames per second.
That's only 20. It's going to last even longer.
Yeah, and someone who's in this house is organizing it to make sure it runs properly. Casually. It's not me.
not me either.
Right, so show people will be screening at the Paramount, which will be lovely. As well as lots of other goodies. I couldn't name, you know, only a few.
Yeah. Something else that was announced, maybe not today, but yesterday, was the fact that the Wellington leg of the festival will be extended by, like, about a squillion sessions.
Yes. Yes, the very exciting bit of, as we head into the last weekend, if you do head to the website, of course, all of the sessions are listed on our website, but definitely check out Show People. Amongst others, Incredibly Strange, all those things. And speaking of, well, not Incredibly Strange, it's actually in the Fresh section. This is sort of NZIF related, because it's a film that is screening at NZIF. The Babadook has been released in France to rave reviews and lots of people going, which is very exciting. And my favorite bit of this news item that I saw today was that they renamed it to Mr. Babadook. So in French, it would be Monsieur Babadook, which just sounds like a completely different film altogether. And I'm just so excited.
It sounds very French all of a sudden.
It does. It does. It does. So yeah, the Babadook is, I believe it's traveling a little bit as well. It's screening tonight in Wellington. So yeah, just keep an eye out for that one.
Cool.
The French love it. So.
And the festival starts, we're recording on a Thursday night, so it's actually kicking off in Christchurch tonight.
It is, indeed. Well, their session started in the day. They have their big opening night with Lunchbox tonight. And yeah, currently there's four festivals running at the same time, which is very exciting. There's Wellington, Dunedin, Christchurch, and Nelson. So as one festival ends, another one comes on.
And if you just happen to be the social media and online coordinator for all of those four festivals, keeping them all straight in your head would be a challenge.
There's a lot of hashtags involved.
Okay.
Excellent. Moving on to other news. Many modern movie fans brought up on CGI effects like a talking raccoon in Guardians of the Galaxy won't be aware of the amazing talent in the fingers of Dick Smith. American Werewolf in London's Rick Baker described him as the greatest makeup artist alive when he won the Academy's Governor's Award in 2011. Sadly, he passed away this week at the age of 92. His credits include the groundbreaking makeup effects on The Exorcist, The Godfather 1 and 2, and his Academy Award-winning aging of F. Murray Abraham in Amadeus.
Mm.
Amazing.
Yeah, and there was much angst and distress at the news of his passing.
Mm. And does anyone actually know what's going to happen to Studio Ghibli now that Hayao Miyazaki has made his last film?
I'm hoping that you're a little bit closer to the all of this to the news. You being a festival person now.
Oh, I wish they should have sent us like directly a message. It would have been handy, seeing as we have two films. Mm. News that was possibly badly translated and then confirmed that it was badly translated. Out of Japan this week suggested the studio would cease production on any new work and manage the property it already owns. And other news claim that the studio is being prepared for sale. Studio Ghibli tweeted out in English that afternoon, "We're still here." News updates came out that they were just taking a short break to decide what they were going to do in the future. So there's no real solid evidence that they are shutting the doors. So it's going to be okay. I think if we just don't panic, stay calm, it's going to be fine. And of course, in any case, if you've seen the documentary about the making of Miyazaki-san's final film, The Wind Rises, and also The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, which is not by Miyazaki, it's by the oh gosh, I can't remember. two fantastic Ghibli films by the sort of the stalwarts of Ghibli.
Yeah.
The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness is the name of the documentary in the NZIF right now. Know that he predicted this would happen. The future is unclear. The future is clear. I can't read. It's going to fall apart. It's inevitable. Deep words.
He knew with whom he works.
And actually, Kingdom of Dreams and Madness is one of the extra sessions that we've had in Wellington. So if you haven't caught it yet, get online. Get your tickets. And if you are one of the film fans who doesn't much care for superheroes and comic book adaptations, you'll be disconcerted to learn that Warner Brothers have announced 9 new DC comic adaptations between 2016 and 2020. None of them have titles yet, so we can only speculate as to what they are.
There's one that's called Untitled Event Film.
Wow.
2020.
Wow. Get to your comic
book store.
Which
is bigger than just Untitled Superhero Film. apparently.
Does mean that we can expect to see up to 6 giant comic book films battling it out for box office supremacy in 2020.
It's incredible. It's and already today was announced that the Superman Batman movie has shifted its release date. You know, there's the sequel to the Superman Man of Steel that has Batman in it with Ben Affleck playing Batman. You're familiar with it. You haven't been in an NZIF bubble all this time. But anyway, they've shifted their opening date to in order to avoid a clash with Captain America 3. Because that would have just been, you know, there's only so much money to go around, right?
Right. Well, when's the Buffy movie coming out?
Well, I did see a tweet today from Joss Whedon with a picture of him looking forlorn and exhausted on the set of the Avengers, saying, "Avengers wrapped. What do I do now?" So
more Buffy.
Yeah, but yeah, obviously that's the thing. In addition to that piece, those pieces of news, something that I'm trying to get into here is just to let you know what's arriving on home video this week, because it's, you know, people, not everybody can get to the movies, right? So Captain America Winter Soldier, this seems to be the Marvel strategy, doesn't it, to release their last film on home video on the same week as their new film comes out at the movies. So there we go. Captain America Winter Soldier, also Muppets Most Wanted comes out this week. The Raid 2.
Good.
Yeah, well, I missed that in all of my busyness earlier on this year. The Red House, which New Zealander Alex Duncan made, that came out a couple of years ago. And we might try and dig out a link to our interview with her for when that film actually arrived in cinemas. That was on the show that we used to do. And Like Father, Like Son, which we're very fond of here, and Trax, which did come out of the movies for a little while, didn't it? Camels Across the Australian Outback movie.
It did.
With Mia Wasikowska.
Divided audiences, I think.
Yeah, and didn't hang around. But there you go, a chance to see that on home video. So that is our news. Joining us here at Rancho Notorious, Kate Hawley. Welcome. It's lovely to have you here. Kate, you're a costume designer by trade, and I mean, we've known each other a long time, back from the days when we were both working in Wellington Theatre. We won't go into how long ago that was, but more recently you've gone from theatre and opera into the movie business. So do you want to start by perhaps telling us a little bit about some of the shows you've worked on, some of the movies that you've worked on, and then we'll ask you for some secret film business that you're not, that you probably...
Oh, and then it'll be on the internet and then it'll be done. No, it's sort of, I suppose in terms of theatre's always been my first love, and actually it was always in Wellington, and a certain visit from Mr. Tony Rabbit and Colin McColl to my Ladies' School of Marsden, and came and spoke, and amongst the effing and blinding and that, there was an amazing vision for Romeo and Juliet. And I remember thinking, God, I want to work like this. And I think that's the start of anything. And I remember, and I think I've always taken those sort of aspirations of how I'd like to work in theatre into the film world. And it's been an organic journey, as is my process. I think it's slightly chaotic, maybe even. And involved getting a grant here in New Zealand. So always the trajectory points for new things happening for me has always happened from New Zealand, which I think is an amazing thing. And I got a scholarship to go and study in London, and I went to the Motley School of Theatre Design, which is sort of like a, you have to, part of the trick of getting into the school is finding it. And but wonderful. And we had people like Mike Lee come and teach us, and we had access to wonderful directors from the National Theatre. And I was taught by Jocelyn Herbert, who was Samuel Beckett's designer. And their process, the things I learned from them in the theatre context, has stood me in the film world, and I think it's just applying those things across. And I got to dabble a bit as an assistant designer, you know, work for nothing, maybe the odd trip to Venice and adventures. I parlayed in adventures instead of cash, you know, being a student.
Yeah. And I recall when you were here, opera was what sort of
absolutely
got you going, and you know, the big scale, the grand, absolutely, the big scenes, the, not just the big frocks, but the big stories as well.
Yeah.
Did you get to do much of that when you went overseas? Did you end up sort of...
Yes, I did work at English National Opera and through Europe, and developed a lot of skills in that. But it was quite interesting because there is a crossover by nature of things, and I got a chance to work on some smaller films and things like that. But what was interesting, in a way, is that what film directors have responded to in my work is the opera and theatre background. And, I mean, you can take a sort of a blockbuster sort of approach to things. I've just come away from seeing Guardians of the Galaxy, and it's totally theatrical and operatic. And when I met Guillermo, again, through a wonderful opportunity through Peter and Fran here in New Zealand, it was the opera work and the theatre work that he responded to. And his work is very theatrical in many ways. So there's a love of having strong imagery and themes and things. Working with him is a bit like music, and so we have this sort of response together that I really feel I'm using all of that background.
Guillermo del Toro was here for a couple of years in Wellington, wasn't he, preparing for a Hobbit that never got made. and he had a reputation as somebody who was quite different to Peter in the sense that he wanted to build everything. Like, he wanted practical, real things rather than to have them sort of constructed after the fact.
Yes. Well, they're both very passionate people, and both are, what I've learned working from all the different directors that I have is that they're all amazing. They all take an idea that you have and make them even more unique than where you thought you could go with it. But the thing about Guillermo is he's a Renaissance man in a way, and he's a painter, and so he, in discussions and things, will often use paintings as quotations. And for example, even when we first met, the thing that I think he responded to and where he offered the chance to work with him was we have similar books. We have a love of Goya and all those wonderful dark romantic worlds and things, so that was our common language. And there's a quality, and also the thing about Guillermo is he sees great beauty in things that are perceived as ugly, or, you know, that you can look at it, for example, if you're just looking at he does it with his monsters, that actually his monsters have a beauty inside, and actually the things that are perceived as beautiful have a great ugliness inside. That's a continual theme in his work, and that applies to textures and everything as well. And I love that, and it does. You know, it's always you always have to give a lot to try and make that work. I mean, I've just come off working on Crimson Peak with him, and, you know, it was so, it's always the sort of, oh, it's just a little film, and it's just it's just 19th century or something like that. And then you realise that actually it's a Baroque world with many, many layers and things, so you're pulling all your literature and quotes from that and visual arts and everything. So everything's so multi-layered, and that comes through in the physicality of every prop. Everything has to have a quality to it. Everything has to tell a story. And I love that. It's like being a forensic detective or something, you know.
I was going to ask you how the process actually works with somebody like Guillermo. Yeah. Like, do you sit at a big drawing table with a big pad of paper and you both draw at the same time to he's like, no, I was thinking something, because he does draw, he does, you know,
he's amazing, he's amazing, he's always scribbling in that wonderful diary of his. And well, with we've got to know each other quite well over the last few projects, and there is a sort of someone said to me that I was sort of like, oh my god, you're like, what is it, a twin sister removed at birth or something. I mean, there is a common language, and there's something that I do the female version of, I know what that is, and so there's a chemistry, and I think that's such an amazing thing to have in a relationship with someone, you know, that there's a chemistry involved, and I think we have that, so that's a wonderful building block to start with. And he's, you know, he's always got a very strong vision of what he wants, but I do have room to move and grow it, and then he'll take it from there and grow it further, as is always a wonderful, it's a process that you can only hope for with every project that you work with. And, you know, so what we will do is, you know, I'll sketch and I'll give him options within things, and he'll be very definite about that. You know, for example, in Crimson Peak, defining the silhouettes of the characters and responding to the architecture is always a big, you know, another layer of what we do in that. So to get those points through, we'll sketch together and do that. But even the colour is such a big motif in his films, huge. And the production designer, Guillermo, and I and the cameraman, we'll all sit together and we'll throw colours. And he's amazing. He'll go, well, it's 5% more of that red or less than that. But he does allow, you know, you can be the person that goes, but what about yellow in there? You know, he does, there's a room to play and do all of that. But he is the boss and it's his pizza, so, you know, to kind of, yeah. Sometimes I have to go, you know, pull myself in a bit and remember it's not my movie. but it's exciting because, you know, there's strength in all the departments when you work with him. And I think this project that we've just done is, well, I'm very excited about it. It's beautiful in so many ways, and he truly is being his most poetic self. And I think those that, without selling it to people, it's more of his Spanish self and that, as opposed to the sort of more blockbuster world.
Well, talking of blockbusters, yeah. Pacific Rim was a huge yeah. project and a huge movie, and yeah. sort of came out of nowhere, unlike all the sort of films we've been talking about tonight, yeah. that have, you know, you hear about them years and years yeah. in advance, right? You know, it's giant fighting robots in the water. What room is there for a costume designer in a film like that? What sort of influence do you get to have?
Well, you have an assistant who says, remember, it's about robots and monsters. When I'm going, but what about this beautiful piece of fabric? The thing is, again, with Guillermo, it's the layers and things, and I can compare it maybe to an orchestral piece or something. Like, you know, there's the big visual, and, you know, so there's the, you know, the monsters, the robots, and the context of that, and with him through colour and in the colour palette and the moods and the environments, you can start making placeholders. I'm not explaining this very well, but everything had a, you know, a big sweep, a big gesture. We had thousands and thousands of extras, and I treated them in a very painterly way. And, you know, so, you know, in the scale, when you see someone that's only not even a tenth of these beasts, you know, you sort of have to be big and broad in your gestures. So we're actually very theatrical with the use of colour. We had the world of the construction zone, where they're building these giant walls, which, if you get very real about, is, you know, it doesn't stand up to any measure of logic, which I also had to kind of put on one side. We had motifs of rust. He had rust in the pools, and then we discussed how we could grow the rust up through the clothes and that. So the construction workers were sort of gestures, painterly gestures of that world. When we came into the world of the Shatter Dome, it was, you know, thousands and thousands of workers, and we had the grey palette of the walls and the machinery and things like that. And when we came to the world of Hong Kong, he had this big thing, and I remember arguing about it. He was going, oh, it's kaiju blue, and I go, why blue? Because it rhymes, you know, because I was thinking, god, yellow would be great because I love yellow. It's kaiju blue. But we wonderful things came out of that, because he built this amazing, there's so much detail that you don't see in Pacific Rim that's sort of heartbreaking but wonderful, because, you know, it's there and you sort of have to go very slowly through the film to see any of it. But in this world of Hong Kong, he has giant carapaces and skeletal remains of these beasts, and people have built homes within it, and the idea that the kaiju blue of the blood is kind of, you know, disintegrated into the world around them, and sort of, you know, it's like a chemical I just remember sort of thinking it's sort of something like it's a poisonous thing, so, you know, people have breathed that in, and we had all these sort of blues coming through the clothes like an illness and things, and through wow. the gas mask. So it's trying to take things that were ordinary and make them more theatrical or more extraordinary within the reality of the world. And then within that, he asked me to find the humanity. So even amongst the thousands of construction workers or the thousands of shattered dome workers, we had characters. I dressed every single person with a small team of people myself, and we created all these characters. I believe there was a whole bunch of sort of Chinese hipsters in there somewhere, or Fellini night like nuns running from the monster. And that is pure Guillermo Ralph, and you don't get that on a film where you have sort of, you know, 40 Fellini nuns running away from a giant monster in and I love that about him. It's, and he's a bit indulgent. He sort of gives me those lollies to sort of play and sort of keep the girl entertained.
Do you also get to on the movies where, you know, where a lot of the detail is filled in digitally? Do you design digital costumes?
Yes.
Too?
Yes, I do. And sometimes that can be, I mean, it's always learning how to work with all these different departments and things like that, because trying to have control or contribute the right textures and things like that, and how to get that scale and how to still get a sense of the individual again on a big scale. But we certainly played with all the textures, and to a certain degree there's, you know, people get scanned in and repeated and things like that, but there's a lot of work like that on films like this. And and again, it was so varied going from something like that to something like Crimson Peak, which is sort of like a Jane Eyre kind of piece where none of that happens and everything had to be built. But, you know, and then you get the extreme of Guillermo still taking his, you know, he's used to sort of, in Pac Rim we had torrential rain, for example, you know, it was monsoon rain and everything's bigger. So the waves that we used on the boat, which was filmed in a studio, he had this sort of 50-foot fishing boat in the studio, and he had 6 fire engines and, you know, water guns and everything going off, and everything about it is always larger and bigger. And then we had a moment in Crimson Peak and he goes, and there's rain. And I go, is that sort of like the rain you had in Pac Rim? Oh no, it's just rain. And then you go, it won't be, it'll always be this torturous sort of amount to deal with. So there's always a physicality, but I love that because it's so visceral and organic and things, and in a way the clothes have to perform as well, and it can make an interesting visual part if you think about it. So
you've just worked with Tom Cruise as well on Edge of Tomorrow, and you know, you've got this fantastic relationship with Guillermo del Toro, this backwards and forwards. And Tom Cruise is notorious for knowing exactly what he wants. You know, that's his reputation.
He does, though. It's not a joke. And I had a lovely introduction into it because Tom and Guillermo had been about to do a project together and that. So there was a sort of blessing that came from Guillermo, which was helpful and started. But Tom knows exactly what he wants, apart from dealing with, oh my God, it's Tom Cruise moment, because we all have that moment where we feel a bit like, you know, children around, and he comes in with his charisma, light beam of eye energy or whatever it is into a room. You go, oh my God, and then realise who you're working for. But he's done more films than most of us put together on projects like that. You know, he is amazingly professional and his energy is unbelievable. I mean, I don't know where the energy comes from, and he's there 24 hours a day, and you know, I have to say, I was terrified of the experience, but he was amazing, and he knows what will look right and what will work for him. And he did put himself in the line of, he did all the stunts and practiced them on behalf of all his acting colleagues and things. So he's just a powerhouse, and he's kind of amazing. But, you know, it provides some interesting discussion and things in a situation, you know, because he's got such a strong idea. But I was you know, very often he's right, so, you know, get paid to do the job. But it was great.
The movie business is where you've been for the last few years. Yeah. Do you still hanker for opera? Would you like to be back in an opera house?
Of course I do. Or I always try and make my films turn into operas, which sometimes has a little bit of resistance. I do. I love it. And I've always thought the ideal way to work would just sort of be to sort of cross from one to another. But it is a bit of a practical difficulty in that, you know, opera requires a longer lead-in time, and that, and films just sort of happen. They're chaos, this film industry. You know, you sort of suddenly you're on board on something and then suddenly you're not, and you never know where you are. But I would like to keep working with directors that have a sense of that theatricalness in their work, and I'd love to just keep being able to have that in the work that I do.
So the question is, do you know what you're doing next?
Well, I had an email last night from the agent that goes, there's lots to discuss. So,
wow. That's always good.
So that's always hopeful, isn't it? I was going, thank God I can pay the electricity bill. it's reality. There's lots of possibilities, and it's just, it's sort of, I suppose one of the things that, personally for me, it is more of a vocation. I'm not a very commercial thinker, so that's something I have to sort of work out as I make this journey about the sort of work that I'd like to do, and, you know, trying to find the things that feed your soul as well as provide fun. And what I have learnt after doing a couple of these blockbusters and that is that there is amazing craftspeople involved, and you can play with a bit of money and have some fun, you know, like you can spend other people's money and really play and have some fun. And so there's, if you approach it like that, there's a lot to be got out of it too. So it's exciting.
Mm. Do you have a scrapbook of all like the fabrics you've used?
I do. And that's a burden because now I've got storerooms in London and Toronto and New Zealand full of that might come in one day kind of thing. And people just go, oh, I haven't learned how to sort of do the nomadic thing with one suitcase. Instead, I travel with six and a daughter and a dog called Brian and a doll's house. I'm going, unbelievable. The doll's house isn't for me, I just have to say. Well, not really, except I'd like to sort of make it like a murder room thing. I do. I end up having lots of boxes everywhere, and I can't help but hoard. It's a sort of nature of our magpie instincts, I think.
And it's also the nature of your job is that you need reference material everywhere and how things feel. I understand.
Don't say that to Colin McCollin Rabbit, because, you know, for years they, all they can say is, and you used to come to meetings and you come with rolls of fabric and boxes of stuff and you can't just have a handbag. But I build on that. It's all experimentation, and I love trying to find the something new. I think it's great. So, yep, I'll just accept my chaos and sort of carry on with all these, you know, suitcases, I think. Yeah.
Kate Hawley, it's been a pleasure having you visit us here at Rancho Notorious. And stay there for a second, because it's time for us to wrap the show up for another week. Next week, crumbs, who knows? Haven't thought about it. Haven't thought that far ahead. But no doubt there will be the usual mix of news, reviews. And next, it's your last week before you go overseas next week. Is that right?
We're going to do an early show.
That's right. So we have two more. Yeah, we have two more shows with Kaylee before she goes overseas. And we've still got to try and work out how on earth we're going to make that work while she's away. But, you know, we have overcome larger problems than that, I'm sure. And at some point, also in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have I'm pretty sure we're going to have an interview with New York writer Glenn Kenny about his book about Robert De Niro, which has just been released by Cahiers du Cinéma and is in all good bookstores now. So, if you've got any questions about the career of Robert De Niro that you'd like us to ask Glenn Kenny, send them through. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us, either email or you can make a comment on the blog. We're live in the iTunes store, so you can subscribe there. Please rate us, give us feedback and reviews and such, so more people will discover the show. It's always good. Apparently the Android apps just need me to fill out a form, so that will be happening over the weekend, and then they will be made available to you all.
And I believe the buttons have arrived.
Yes, indeed, we have. Thank you very much to Sue Tyler, who has given us... people who, like me, grew up in England will know that there was a show called Blue Peter, and everybody who appeared on Blue Peter got a Blue Peter badge, and we have a Rancho Notorious button for all of our guests. We'll be posting those out to guests who have been on the show prior to this. And very exciting. They are gorgeous.
Excellent. You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast, all one word, where we'll be tweeting incessantly, slightly more incessantly in a couple weeks, when I finished my contract, about things that we think are interesting and that we would like to share with you. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too. Username is Rancho Notorious.
We don't do Facebook, just in case anyone's...
No, it's too much work.
Yeah, way too much work. And they're so inflexible, those people. This show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Corray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Loz Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. About half of the baby boomer-friendly soundtrack of Guardians of the Galaxy is decent, the other half less so. But here's the song that I like best. It's the Jacksons, and I Want You Back. back. Thanks very much to our guests, Carter and to Kate. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
I have so many more questions for you. I'm so glad we're having dinner.
I have so much more to share.
We're off to go and have some dinner now. Roast beef is waiting for us in the other room. Thanks for listening. That's good night from me, Dan Slavin.
And good night from me, Kaylee Carruthers.